It was a good experience for us to go from the fine dining world of Bartolotta's to the casual, insanely busy world of Pizza Man. And that really helped us solidify what is it that we really want to be? What can we be good at? Because we've done these things now, we've seen these different approaches to it. What do we want for our life?
Hello, and welcome to Food Crush, the On Milwaukee podcast for people who eat and complain about olives. I am your co-host, Matt Miller, culture editor at OnMilwaukee.com, and I am joined, as always, by Lori Frederick, dining editor and olive enthusiast at OnMilwaukee.com. How are you doing
today? Good olive lover, yes, at least.
Yeah, how are you doing today, Lori?
I'm doing great.
We're a little loopy right now because this is podcast two of the day, which is always the goofier of the two. And also, we were just talking before we went on mic about psychological blocks to food and olives and raisins and mushrooms. And it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah. Although, not all the polarizing foods, but some of them.
Yeah. I mean, we didn't bring up durian, which I've never tried. I'd like to try durian.
I think durian tastes better than it smells.
That's what I will say.
No, that is not true.
I think the common opinion on durian is everything tastes better than it smells.
So, yeah. But we're here with some not so ridiculous guests.
They are smiling their way through my food takes.
Yeah.
Politely.
We're here with Zach and Sarah Baker of Kalu Kenzo. And they're going to take us down a road that I think will be delicious. I don't know. They both, you know, Kalu Kenzo is an Italian restaurant in, technically, you're in Wauwatosa, yes?
One block.
Dear guests. That specific part of Wauwatosa, I always have to think, like, where does it end? Where does it begin?
Who really knows, honestly?
But these are well-traveled folks who have gone to Italy, fallen in love with Italy, and started a concept, a restaurant that is, like, I don't know, sometimes about the best place I can think of.
Thank God we're talking Italian food after I finished my homemade mac and cheese that they would almost certainly judge. Almost certainly would judge harshly. Though I will say, I think I make a pretty good mac and cheese.
So I think the fact that you made it yourself is...
And it's not Kraft. Really, it's not Kraft mac and cheese.
We're not that tough of judges, I think. Maybe if we're paying a lot of money for it, then, if you showed up with mac and cheese, we would not harshly judge you or be, unkind.
I appreciate that. My cat is walking on my computer, so if something weird just happened to the audio, my apologies.
No.
Animals, they're so much fun.
Yeah. So I thought we might start with a journey to the past. Because you guys both have been in the industry for a while, but I personally don't know what you did before that, if anything. I don't think. And so maybe we can start there. I don't. Which of you wants to first?
I'll go first, just because I feel like Sarah's used to me rambling about this. I'm from Door County, and when you work in Door County, you can get a job a year earlier than the rest of the state because they rely on the younger people to work for tourism.
And
really? I had
so
some
is that
friends.
Like so is that like age 13 then?
It's 13 or 14, and the rules change over the years. I just know when I got my job, I was younger than I was told other places allowed. I don't know, or maybe it was just illegal. I'm not entirely sure. And you either can get a job at a restaurant or you can get a job cleaning rooms. And I wasn't going to clean rooms. Like, I was a teenager. I didn't clean my own room. I wasn't going to do it for other people for money. But I had a friend who worked in a restaurant in the kitchen. So through that connection, I got a job there. And they made me a busser in the front of house. and I was the worst busser that had ever lived. and it wasn't just
how do you know?
It wasn't just like that. They were always mean to me and always told me I was doing a bad job, and they wouldn't really tip me out as much as the other bussers. Like I knew I was doing a bad job.
What because were you of the doing way wrong?
I'd never had a job before, so I was not engaged. Like, I never tried to think ahead, like, oh, I should move this here because I'm going to be busy in 2 minutes doing this. Like, none of that would ever occur to me. Like, I was
an average teenage worker at a restaurant. Yeah,
well, thus the struggle in Door County. But some of us teenagers would stay around for a while. Rather than getting fired as a busser, I begged to work in the kitchen washing dishes with my friends. And once I got there, I don't know. It's kind of a tale as old time. Like, I just never looked back. Dishwashing begat prep cooking, begat like the cold station in the back part of the kitchen, begat, you know, oh, I get to fry the shoestring potatoes for the broiled whitefish tonight because the other guy didn't show up because he was blindingly blitzed and hungover when he showed up at 3 p.m. from the last night still. So it was like a baptism by fire. And I had some bosses who, because it changed a little bit. Some of them, they would come and go. So it was kind of interesting to see different people do it. But they always would kind of like put their confidence in me to do something or like do something new. So I was very lucky. I don't know. Like, I felt like that was my culinary school. I looked into going to culinary school after that. I decided not to. Just because I felt like I'd had a pretty good foundation in terms of like an education of how a restaurant works and baking and stocks, sauces, soup. I mean, we made everything there. Yeah. So I didn't set out to be a chef. It wasn't until the end of high school when you have the what do you want to be when you grow up conversation and go to college and stuff like that, when I kind of realized that I didn't want to go to college and do something else. And the guys at work were like, why don't you just do this? So I did. Eventually came to Milwaukee to work for the Bartolotta family. And that was an eye-opening experience. You know, it was like being in a restaurant that you read about in magazines or like fancy cookbooks, like this regimented, very orderly, like very planned, very choreographed service. I saw it and I was instantly like, this is awesome. You know, this was Ristorante in 2003 too. This is like pre-Bacchus, pre-Piccola, like pre-Empire, essentially, like Bartolotta. So, you know, like you saw the bosses all the time. When you did events, everybody was there. Like it was a very awesome experience to start in Milwaukee. And then, you know, worked 10 years with Bartolotta, ended at Lake Park, left to do Pizza Man for a few years. But the goal was always for us to do this. And that's how I got here.
Yeah. And Sarah, your trajectory is a little bit different.
Totally. Absolutely.
She wasn't the worst busser in the
I was not.
She was actually a very good busser if she did that. Sarah's an overachiever in every job she's ever had.
No. I started in, I guess, hospitality in high school. I worked at coffee shops. I worked a retail job for like a second, and it was awful, and never.
What was the
to do
what was
again.
The re- what was the retail job?
TJ Maxx in Brookfield.
Oh yeah, I can
Not
imagine.
Fun.
I can imagine.
Such nice ties, though.
No. So I worked coffee. Went to college to get a degree in journalism. Worked coffee through that. Worked at Starbucks back in 1999, 2000.
So like early heyday Starbucks.
Yeah.
Manual shot Starbucks.
Yeah. Yeah. So like when, you know,
and Starbucks
they did,
was coffee.
Exactly.
I mean, that was, yeah.
Totally.
So we'd do like cuppings and tastings and like all of that all the time. Went to the University of Minnesota, so it was busy, very busy all the time. So I guess that kind of like tuned me into what hospitality was, because the type of hospitality you create at 5 a.m. for a bunch of college students is not always the easiest. So did that. That afforded me the opportunity to travel because there's Starbucks everywhere. I lived in Denver for a while doing it there after I graduated. And then my first restaurant job was at this River Saloon in Minnesota. And it was the worst, like the worst. Terrible. I swore I would never be a server again. I had no idea what I was doing.
It gave River Saloons a bad name.
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh.
I take it the training was lacking.
There was no training. It was like, oh, you're in college. You know how to do that. You've been to a restaurant before, right? You're fine. You have 10 tables. Go. I would cry every day. Swore I would never, ever work at a restaurant again.
Lo and behold.
Yes. Then I got like a day office job and realized, wow, sitting at a desk is way worse than 10 tables at a River Saloon. So let's try that again. Worked at Cheesecake Factory when it opened here in Wauwatosa as a host. That was a crazy experience.
Well, that's like, not 10 tables. That's just 150,000 menu items.
But. Yeah, so much. And as a host, that it was crazy when we first opened. It would be like a six-hour wait, and you would have to tell people to come back in 4 hours for their buzzer to be on the real wait.
Is it just the all the food thing? Is that why there is the Cheesecake Factory craze? Because those places just print money.
I don't know, man.
They do.
I'm still confused after having worked there why people would wait 6 hours. I really don't know. Yeah, it doesn't make any sense.
Not only do people not tend to want to wait for anything, you know, at least, I don't know, at least here in the Midwest, let alone, you know, I don't know. That's bizarre, let alone 4 or 6 hours.
You know? Yeah, I mean, it probably helped that there is a mall. Like, you can go shop.
That helps, for 6 hours.
But you don't get hungry. You don't get less hungry, you know?
No.
You crush like a Cinnabon and ruin dinner.
You go drink an Orange Julio, which is what we always call
Orange Julio. I ate a whole Sbarro pizza in the time it took for us to get there.
And now I just want cheesecake, which is
That's the funny thing, though, because like I know people love the cheesecake at Cheesecake Factory, which admittedly... tasty cheesecake. Not going to complain too much about it. But, like, I don't ever hear anyone be like, oh, the food at Cheesecake Factory. That is chef's kiss. Like, it's just I think 6 hours the one thing for a meal say, that you're like, okay with seems like a lot.
Yeah. I can't defend any of that, nor, like, the waiting for it. Though I will say that if you're talking about big, like, mega chain restaurants, for having a menu this size that they had, they did remarkably well,
yeah,
at executing at least, I don't know, probably the three items I've ever eaten.
I had luck working with people who had worked at Cheesecake Factories before, because, well, besides the obvious pairing of Sarah and I, but I mean, other cooks that worked for us when we were running Pizza Man came in, and they definitely were better in able to adjust at the volume that we were doing.
I think it helps that their training is very extensive, and it's also like based in a family business, right?
Okay.
David Overton, I think his name was, is the one who started it based on his mom's cheesecake recipe. So there's like a story in a family and a community, I guess, that you get behind when you're there. They also did a fairly well, at least back then, they took care of their staff. So I think that helps. But from there, I really wanted to be a server. Really wanted to be a server because that's how you make money. And I wanted to quit my day job, and I couldn't do that on my host money. So tried to be a server there. And they're like, no, you have to stay as a host. So I applied to be a server at Bartolotta's when Ristorante on Downer was opening.
Remember that? Yeah, I do remember that. And that was a relatively short-lived.
So short-lived.
Yeah. Yeah, so short-lived. Yeah, we don't even talk even about that anymore. It. Yeah. No. I don't. Yeah. Where was it on Downer?
It's where the Pancake House was. Yeah.
Bel Air.
That was a ristorante?
Yeah.
Because it was
after a Piccolo failed there.
Yeah, because it was when the Coffee Trader closed.
Yep.
And they started looking at, like, and that space got divided up because of Coffee Trader. I mean, that was coffee, I guess, that we had, you know. That place was kind of awesome. I have good memories of Coffee Trader, even though it's probably on the young end.
No. Sure.
Enjoying that. So, but yeah, okay. So you did get the job?
I did get hired. I did not get the job on Downer, which is great. I grew up in Tulsa. I was at the time living in my parents' basement after my failed Denver experience.
We've all done it.
Yes. So they ended up putting me at Ristorante in Tulsa as a server, which is where I met Zach.
Serendipity, right?
Yes, it really was. So worked there and immediately fell in love with the vibe. Unlike Zach, I didn't really look at culinary magazines. I didn't read cookbooks. I literally, when I met Zach, I was eating Wonder Bread and SpaghettiOs. Like, food was not
a huge thing for me. This is a pro SpaghettiO podcast. Yes. We are pro SpaghettiO here.
Should try it with olives. Sorry.
I don't even do the hot dogs. Like, I just do my princess SpaghettiOs. Or if I'm lucky, the superhero shapes. I get fewer weird looks from the person at the register if I have the superhero shapes.
I love it. Love it. Yeah, we would have been best of friends. So yes, didn't really know a lot about food. Didn't grow up in a foodie family. So it was totally captivating to work at Ristorante at that time. Juan was the chef. The manager was a guy named Mark who just knew so much about wine and was excited about wine. Juan just also has this crazy photographic memory, can tell you how a wine tasted that he drank 25 years ago and tell you exactly what food he ate. It's amazing. And everyone that worked there at that time was excited. And I think it's kind of, or at least it seems kind of rare to be in a situation where everybody wants to go to work. Everybody is excited to be at work and hang out with their friends and also do this work thing, but share this collective excitement about it. So very easy to fall in love with what was going on there and fall in love with Zach too, I guess, in the process. And there was almost never a day that went by that we didn't talk about, well, what would we do if this was our restaurant? You know, I think I just had that entrepreneur spirit in me, and I didn't know what I was going to do. I didn't know that it would be food. I didn't know that it would be restaurant, but I knew I wanted to do something that was my or our business. I didn't know it would be our business at the time, but definitely something that I got to call the shots and be my own boss. So worked at Ristorante. As soon as they found out that Zach and I were dating, we tried to be very secretive about it. Although I'm pretty sure.
Can I ask the question?
You had to drop me off in the morning. I didn't have a car.
I know. And I'm pretty sure Jennifer Bartolotta saw me drop him off one day and was like, that's interesting. What is going on there?
This carpooling is suspicious.
Yes. Saving gas money.
Was it a situation where, you know, Sarah walks into the room and Zach, and there were lights and, How long did it take before you would make
Bartolotta, they probably still do it. Bartolotta would have front of house people work in the kitchen for, was it five shifts? Four shifts?
It was on every station.
Yeah, they'd make you have this Burn Hazard on your station with you all night.
But that was for a well-rounded experience.
Oh, totally. It's amazing. It's awesome. It's awesome. And I remember having Sarah clean an entire produce bin of Brussels sprouts. But I felt like we hit it off. I don't know. Sometimes you just kind of have a rapport with somebody. And, you know, Sarah had told me about some of her recent friends and people she had been dating. And I told her I was not impressed with any of these stories by these people. And she could do so much better, like me. And actually, it's very funny. I'll just give you the real story. So, like, Sarah put a wine stem into her, the palm of her hand, training behind the bar during her training. And, you know, had this kind of blood gushing problem with her hand. And being the manager on duty, I was just kind of the one that was free at that moment to triage and check this out and see, you know, assess like, okay, is this like a band-aid sort of thing? Or is this a, we need to bring somebody to the emergency room to get stitches kind of thing? And she was fine. But I was like kind of tenderly bandaging her hand up, which again, this is like, you know, I'll get canceled for stuff like that nowadays. But I was like kind of bandaging her hand up. I was like, oh, you know, we should go out and have a drink or something like that after this, you know, this is, you know, just talk more. And geez, man, I feel like we were living together like a week later.
That's sweet.
Like, boom.
Yeah.
So it worked out really well for us.
It did. Yeah.
One of many Bartolotto marriages, I'm told.
So many.
I was going to say that does seem to be a thing.
Yeah.
But when you have people together who are happy, like, mm-hmm. who like what they're doing.
Totally.
Like, I do think that creates an environment where you fall in love with people, not in a way you wouldn't outside, but maybe you find them sooner. Because people are in the right state of mind to actually be pleasant to each other.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to lie. Zach is not like any other person I ever dated before, ever. I brought him home and my mom was like, oh, I like him. He looks at me in my eyes. He shook my hand. So, yes, definitely a major upgrade for me. But yeah, so we would talk about restaurants all the time and what we would do different. And, you know, when you're 24, 25 years old, like, you know how to do everything better than everybody that does at what you do anyway. So, you know, we had lots of grand ideas about what it would be and how we would do it and why aren't they doing it this way? This is how we would do it. But realizing really quickly, I mean, Zach would be part of P&L meetings, right? So you get to go through all of the statements. And I think it was maybe about that point that we realized like, oh, so there's this whole other part of restauranting that isn't cooking food and isn't taking care of guests. Like this is going to be a blind spot for us. So how do we remedy that? Like, Zach is not going to go work in an office to learn that part of the thing. Like, he needs to do the cooking thing. So I was probably really, really obnoxious to Bartolotta's for a while. I would apply to every single management job, every single office job that they ever posted. I was probably...
This is true. She was the squeaky wheel. Like, Sarah. They were stuck with her, and they just didn't know what to do about it.
Sarah, the most obnoxiously motivated employee.
Yes. Yeah. Every job. Yeah. I must have interviewed with John Wise for, like, 8 jobs, and he would always be like, I don't know. What? Why do you think you can do this? I can do anything, man. I got this. So eventually, they did hire me to be the person who did the data entry for the rewards. So, you know, when you fill out the things and you're super drunk at the end of the night and you don't really remember your phone number, I was the one who was deciphering those and putting them into the rewards database. But that quickly turned into...
That sounds like a desk job, Sarah.
It was. But I got to do my restauranting at night. So that saved me.
I mean, they finally relented and let her do something. They were like, you can do this thing in this corner over here.
Okay, you can come into the super secret office
and learn the secret things. But they let her in the building. They let her in the corporate office, and that was all it took.
Yes. Yeah. So then I became Joe's assistant. I was Joe's assistant for a handful of years. And Joe knew from the beginning that we wanted to open a restaurant. He knew that that's what our goal was. And it was the doors that he opened for me and in turn for us. I can't understate. Like, it was amazing. I got to sit in on all of the director meetings. So I had this amazing view into what made that company that company. And working with someone like Joe, who wasn't always the most practical business person, but was a lover. He was definitely unconventional. He was a lover of people and a true believer in hospitality. And that if you did the right things and you put the people first, that the business would turn out. And it would be what you wanted it to be. So always having that as like the foundation of how to go about having this business. And I don't even think it's a restaurant business. I think that can apply to any business. So doing that was amazing. Towards the end of my time at Bartolotta's, I became the HR director. They helped me go through school to get certified to do that. So amazing learning opportunities there. And then from there,
you got to go to director meetings.
Yeah, which weren't always the most fun.
No, I would have killed to go to director meetings when I was at Bartolotta's. That would have been so fun.
Yeah, you would have been a terror.
Not for me. Not for
them. Yes. And then Zach got a job doing consultant work for Pizza Man. And within, I think, a week of the Pizza Man on Downer opening, they called me and asked me if I wanted to do operations consulting. I had been working at Circa 1880 as the general manager at that time and like wine director there, because I also have wine certification through the Wine Spirit Education Trust. So we did that. It was supposed to be like a couple months before we opened a restaurant of our own, and Pizza Man turned into 5 years of our life. And that was a really great experience for us together. I think building, like, Pizza Man is a huge Milwaukee icon, right? So you're starting it new, you're trying to put like your own thing.
Yeah, because for context, this is like Pizza Man had burned down.
Yes.
And then it was, you know, and I mean, and I remember thinking, how do you bring something like that?
Oh, my gosh.
Because it's not just, you know, the door with all the weights on it. You know, you're moving to a new location. Like, you're trying to bring back something that was, like, time has passed. Nostalgic things are hard to bring back. Excuse me, because nostalgia thwarts everything.
Yeah, totally. I mean,
like your memories become, like, impossible to beat.
Yeah.
And I remember briefly interviewing you, Zach, when like you kind of had the recipes for the things.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I just remember thinking, how is this going to work?
I mean, at one point, Mike Pizza Man, Mike Abizu, he had said something to me about this, like there was a specific spice blend that went into the pizza sauce for Pizza Man Pizza. And he had had somebody producing it for us. Yeah. He had had somebody like producing them in like pre-portioned packets so you could just make like a case of sauce at a time, which was smart. But he had misplaced his writing of the recipe. And when he asked them for it, they said that he had sold it to them and they wouldn't give it to him. But luckily, because I'm a pack rat and I just, you know, every restaurant I've ever worked in, I have like meticulous notes in whatever files they ever accidentally gave me as a photocopy. I definitely kept my whole life. I had Mike's recipe, so I got to give him back his recipe at one point when I was at Pizza Man. He was a great guy. Mike was he is the Pizza Man. He just had talk about another unconventional guy. We work for these totally unconventional.
I was going to say, we're talking about Joe Bartolotta and Mike all in the same.
Mike was like a marketing genius, like a savant almost, like could come up with these just obscene.
Well, because he started out selling things at like music festival.
Oh, yeah.
He was the chicken man.
Sarah talks about wanting to be her own boss. And I mean, that was Mike to a T, man. Like Mike was just always going to do, like Mike could have sold pizza. He could have sold chicken. He could have, he had a gumball machine business?
Yes.
Yeah. We would go and sit with Mike at his house, like, you know, as he got kind of older and stepped away from the restaurants, we just pick up some food and go and hang out. He would just tell us the wildest stories about how he got into business and the things he had done and some of the crazy things that happened at the old Pizza Man, which is just, I mean, my God, people think restaurants are crazy. They don't even know, man. That place is, it sounds, I'm not even gonna, I can't go on record with some of that stuff. You know, I'll tell you guys sometime when you're here having a glass of wine or something, but
yeah,
it's crazy. But I mean, he had a full, rich life, and you know, working with him with Pizza Man, I think it took a little time for him and I to kind of gel a little bit. But you know, we're two people in very different places in our, you know, careers at that point. But you know, by the end of it, I felt like he and Sarah and I had gotten pretty close.
Yeah. Well, and Sarah, you ended up in charge of like operations and really a wine list that had become legendary too. The largest, I mean, because they had the biggest California wine collection mostly California. Okay.
Yeah. I knew nothing about wine before I started with Ristorante. So my whole intro to wine was all Italian wine. And definitely have clearly a soft spot in my heart for Italy and Italian wine, and then going to Pizza Man and it being this whole other thing of domestic wine, which is like can be the polar opposite of Italian wine. So learning all of that, growing the business to 3 restaurants through our 5 years there.
That's why we have a 10 table restaurant now.
Yes, that is why we have a 10-table restaurant right now. Just the staffing. It was a good experience for us to go from the fine dining world of Bartolotta's to the casual, insanely busy world of Pizza Man. And that really helped us solidify what is it that we really want to be? What can we be good at? Because we've done these things now. We've seen these different approaches to it. What do we want for our life? We were lucky enough, because of Pizza Man, to be able to sell a lot of wine. And one of our distributors at one point, we beat some like huge sales projection thing, and they took us on a trip to Italy.
Oh, wow.
In 2018. And it was Zach, myself, and then at that point, we had Tosa.
Oak Creek was open.
And Oak Creek. Opened, so. Yeah. Yeah, we had all three at that point. So
we were working on the bottle house thing, or 42 or whatever they call it now.
Oh, yeah.
The glass and griddle.
Glass and griddle. Yeah. So, yes, we were working on that at the time. And our wine director also came with us on this trip to Italy. And it was an amazing trip. It was, I think, 10 days, mm-hmm. 7, something like that. And of course, you're going with your distributor, so you taste all of the properties that they represent, or at least most of them. Yeah. So
we're on a bus with, you know, people from all over the country. There was like maybe 20 of us. You know, they sell wine, or they run restaurants, or they're a distributor. Like, I mean, from New York, from Atlanta, from LA. Like, they, you know, like we were just the people from Milwaukee.
Yeah, so we're essentially living on this bus for 10 days with these people, going to sometimes 4 wineries a day. I think the least we ever did was 3 wineries a day. So you wake up, sometimes have like 3, 4, 5 hours of sleep, start drinking immediately. And by the
On the bus, you start. Yeah, there was always a pretty game of sparkling wine, like, first thing. But they were nuts.
Oof, it was. But by the middle of the trip, I think it was the middle of the trip, we were in Barolo and had tasted at a couple wineries and then ended up at this property in Barolo at the end of the night. And Zach got seated next to a gentleman who made vermouth, Oscar Vermouth. And he was telling Zach about how he had this other job, but, you know, it wasn't filling his soul or whatever. Like, wasn't doing the things that he wanted it to do. So he said, you know what, screw it. I'm going to leave and I'm going to make vermouth. And it's called Oscar 697 because the story is he went through 697 recipes before he settled on the one that it would be.
That's so much vermouth.
Which so is, not, much. Is not entirely unbelievable in the world of vermouth. Because all vermouth is
but
like,
it
okay,
is
this
terrifying.
Is a wine. This is a wine.
It is, that's yeah.
Good, you know? I feel like every time imagine, I make something, I tinker with the recipe. So, I mean, I would, what version
but I
am
feel
I on?
Like by like recipe 477, I'd be like, you know what? I think this will work for now.
Totally.
Although when you're in that mindset, what I am more amazed about is that he actually kept keeping track of the number.
Yeah.
You know, provided that the story is not
my
mythology.
My potentially dumb question is how can vermouth have that many variations of recipe? What is it about vermouth that can result in almost 700?
Because,
There's so many different botanicals and herbs. Yeah, okay. Like, yes. So, and then how much of each goes in it. So, I mean, it could be like we put two sprinkles of something in it, and now we're doing 2.5.
Sprinkles. It's probably like in grams or something.
Oh, I would measure it.
And this is often that. It's kind of like making gin. You know?
Yeah. There's the element of time, right? Long does something steep? I think when you have something with that many botanicals and herbs and stuff like that, and then you factor in the time thing, there's probably about a million different variations. I mean, if you just did like whatever sort of mathematical equation you could look at, but
that's horrifying.
Yeah.
That is terrifying.
But you said like you can't believe the guy took notes or kept track. I mean, I think there's people in the world who like to tinker with stuff like that, and the note taking is just kind of part of it.
Yeah.
Like you.
Sometimes you wind up going backwards 20 versions and find something else that you like.
697 or whatever versions of it, you might as well keep track of all of them. You might as well have a documentation of it.
I mean, he's done well enough that some little restaurant on the other side of the planet, Milwaukee, has his vermouth, you know. Okay. So
must have hit it.
Yeah.
I was going to say, must have hit it out of the park.
It's delicious stuff, you know.
967th time. Yeah.
So he made quite the impression.
Right? Like hit a million.
Or like a wine. Like it's just every successive release is a little different. Yeah. Just keep tinkering.
What if you did hit like, even if it wasn't perfect, but like if you made like a vermouth 1 million and it would be like, this is the 1 millionth version of it. And I hope it's good.
Like, yeah, I feel like you just have to go with it at that point.
Yeah.
Well, this is it.
Yeah.
There's got to be a diminishing return at some point.
At some point, your taste buds have to be like, there's literally
At some point,
no
you
difference.
Just go back to recipe number two. And you're I actually just did it right.
Like the millionth recipe, you drink it, it just tastes like the most perfect cola. You're like, I think this is too much.
I would die if it was like, you hear about that on movie sets sometimes where they do like 27 takes of a scene or something.
And the first one.
And then the director's like, the second one was fine. And it's just like, I hate you.
Yeah.
I hate you with all. If I made over 600 vermouths, and by the end was like, you know, the seventh one was pretty good. Yeah. Like, I would walk into Lake Michigan.
Creativity loves spontaneity.
This is true.
It's true.
So,
So yeah, we had the vermouth.
So, I'm sitting at dinner in this open vessel, been drinking all day. And I hadn't been back to Italy since my last stop. So this was almost like 10 years from my last stop, my last few years in Bartolotta and years working at Pizza Man, I was too busy to take a month off and just go and gallivant around Italy and like work for free. And I knew when I got back there that it would be a problem because it had been long enough and I could tell that I was kind of like burning out on the big restaurant group kind of life. And I was getting very kind of desperate for us to do our own thing. And I knew going to Italy was going to be like a jump over the edge sort of moment for us, or at least for me. So, you know, this guy, Stefano, is like bearing his soul to me about his business. And I'm like, look at him. I'm like, do you have any cigarettes? He's like, yes, I do. I'm like, let's go outside and smoke some, please. So I'm like outside drinking vermouth and smoking cigarettes with this guy. Sarah and Carly wander out. I'm like, guess what, babe? We are quitting our fucking jobs when we get home. Sorry, I probably can't swear on your kid.
No,
we
yes,
are
you can.
Quitting our jobs. You can beep it or whatever. I'm sorry. I'm just being authentic. That's what I said, I'm sure.
We are a swear-friendly podcast.
But I said we're quitting our jobs when we get back, and we're going to do our thing because why wait any longer? You know, I felt like we were getting to a point where the jobs and like being in administration and stuff like that were going to become too easy of a life and we would never get back out of it. Like we were going to forget how to grind and how to like work it the way it deserved to be worked and would have to be worked to be as good as we wanted it to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think you put in your notice about a month after we got back. And I was still deciding if I wanted to do that at that point because it was terrifying to me to be like, okay, let's just stop working and something, the universe will deliver us something. Like, that's not how life works in my mind. So
just jump, Sarah.
Yeah, blah, no. Yeah. It's like, we have a house and mortgage and no, we can't do that. But then... I mean, I thought about what he said. How old were we at that time? Late 30s? 30s?
Like
whatever.
36.
And I was like, well, you know what? It's true. If we don't do this now, I don't think I'm going to want to open a restaurant when I'm 50. Mm-hmm. Then I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe I would. So I started looking, calling real estate agents and being like, what is even available? We looked at the Circa spot because Thomas had closed by then and toured it and it just wasn't the right fit. But the real estate agent who showed us was like, oh, how do you feel about Tosa? And I was like, well, we live there and I grew up there. So yeah, sure, we'll look at a place. And he gave us the address, but he didn't tell us what it was. And we showed up, I think, the next day to look at it. And, of course, I Googled it right away. And I was like, oh, Juniper, the old Jake's.
Juniper is 61.
Hmm. So we came to look at it. And they were still open. And it wasn't, like, super... it wasn't known that they were looking to close. At least we didn't think so. So we were, like, auditors. I think they told the staff that we were, like, auditor people. And I was like...
Zach totally looks like an auditor.
So he toured it a couple times, and I immediately fell in love with it. It was always in my head that we would have a place in Tosa that would be on the corner, that there would be living space above it. It was everything that I had been thinking it would be. There's a parking lot, there's a patio, like everything. And I guess I didn't really think about it being a 100-year-old building and what that would mean. But, you know,
every good building is 100 years old.
Yes, you know? Exactly.
And every modern new building falls apart because it's not built as well as, you know,
totally.
It's just a set of different issues.
Please don't depress me, Lori.
Well, it's true. You know, when you buy a house, you know, you figure all that out.
I
bought a really old house and the old house problems are weird, but not any worse than, you know.
Exactly.
Modern houses, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Totally. So we started looking at it in must have been, we stopped working at Pizza Man in September, and we didn't end up closing on the building until December of 18. Then we did our build out January through May and opened Kalu Kenzo on May 18th of 2019.
Which is remarkable. Like, I think about that now, and with things moving so slowly after a time, like, especially right now, like, that was a really fast.
Yeah.
It did seem to go very fast. And I don't, it's been kind of a weird couple years with the stops and the starts, I think, more than anything, just to stop and start. And we've told people this before, but we were open like 9 months when, you know, COVID part one hit. And you never get a chance in this job to like stop and think about what you're doing, because the next day you have to ring the bell and get dinner ready for everybody who's coming. You know, like you're always, there's not a lot of time to like regard it. You can talk about it as much as you want, like in the morning. I mean, in Sarah, I talk about it constantly, no matter what. But to have that little bit of time there to think about it was kind of, I'm not saying COVID was a good thing, but we tried to find something positive out of it. And I think being able to think about what we had done up to that point, because I thought it was going really well and people liked it a lot. But it was nice to think about it and kind of, again, tinker, you know, like in like, tune things a little bit differently, or kind of go into that summer on the patio with like a specific goal of like trying a couple ideas out. Not the food, just the feel and the vibe, you know?
Yeah, there was a kind of freedom allotted during that summer, since it was like, who knows what's going to happen? Like, everything's weird. Society's ruined. Like, we don't know what anyone's going to be doing. So let's see what we can create. Well, let's see what we can come up with. What's the worst that happens?
Yeah. Well, and I think you guys did, you know, you made an impression because you were open for, it would have been 9 months. Which gave you, I mean, so that's the better part of a year. And you must have built a reputation, because then you stayed closed for quite a while.
We did. We closed the weekend before. So we stayed open just right before St. Patrick's Day.
March 13th, March 14th, something like that.
I think that was when the bar shut down,
And then everything else came after. We ended work Saturday. It was an eerie weekend. You know, you could kind of tell, because there was this like sort of like last dinner on earth vibe going on. Like, you could just feel this weird tension in the dining room. Like, people were there, but they weren't sure if they should be.
I remember.
Including all of us. And I kind of... it was like, oh, this is going to get serious, like, coming up here. And then literally by Sunday afternoon, we had made a decision to close. Like, it was, like, it just went super fast.
Yeah. So, I mean, luckily, we planned for what happens if we're not busy when we open. When we were, like, figuring out what our operating capital should be back when we opened in May. And we were decently busy in the beginning. So we didn't really have to break into our oh no money. So, you know, we had some funds available during that closed time to continue paying our staff and be like, okay, everybody, we have no idea what's going to happen. You're terrified. We're terrified. We're not going to put in, almost all of our team has small kids. So we're like, we're not going to open right now. We aren't comfortable with what's going on. We'll continue to pay you as much as we can for as long as we can. And, you know, just kept that going. So we were closed all of April, all of May, and then opened in June with just patio. We're open just patio for that first summer. And then did carry out. Kept all of our kitchen employed. I kept front of the house engaged by doing wine tastings. They would come every Wednesday, pick up little vials of wine, and we tasted through the entire wine list over Zoom. over that winter to just like stay talking to each other and not feel like we were all going crazy living in our houses, you know, secluded yeah. from everything. So we were able to retain a lot of our team. And I think that helped us really figure out what Kalu Kenzo could be. Because when you're writing your business plan and like pitching it to banks to get loans to open, like you're basically like throwing your, like licking your finger and throwing it to the wind. Like what is this going to be? Who knows? We have an idea of what it could be, but you don't know until you open. So having had those 9 months, having all of our team essentially stay, we were able to open that summer with a patio. So excited to be working because we're like, yeah. yes, we're not in our house. This is amazing. We can see people that we're not related to right. and create this awesome experience. And people that first summer were so grateful. It was probably one of the most amazing summers that any of us in hospitality have ever had because everyone was super kind. Everyone was super understanding. They were excited. It was great. Like guests were amazing. Not that they're not now, but it was just different.
And people have gotten a little bit grumpy.
Yep, that's they sure have.
She's talking about
yeah. 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 People by and large are not terrible, but there's definitely been an ugly side that has, you know, I mean.
Yeah, which is understanding, man. Life is totally like continues to be right scary now, in different ways. Weird. So
Yeah.
Yes. I think that what Kalu Kenzo is now wasn't necessarily what it was going to be when we were trying to write it all down on paper, but I think it's infinitely better than what we imagined it to be.
And you must have made enough of an impression in that first 9 months with the idea as it initially came through that people, because I feel like people were pretty loyal, you know, yeah. and came back.
Yeah, we have some amazing regulars. And Tosa is a great place to have a restaurant. I mean, this community supports local business like no other. I mean, people come out and they're great supporters. And I feel it. We don't really do any marketing. Do Instagram.
You do great podcasts.
And podcasts. yeah, but, you know, we don't pay for, like, ads. I think it's more authentic to have that word of mouth. And that's another thing that Joe was super all mm-hmm. about. That we try to make every person's experience an amazing personal experience for them. We don't treat all of the tables the same because none of the tables are the same. Everyone's experience is different. What they're looking for when they sit down is different than the table next to them. Our team is different. There's so many amazing personalities on our team that just like stepping back and giving them the opportunity to do what they're amazing at. We have all professional servers. So, you know, I think that giving people the opportunity to do their best work in this like broad framework of what we want it to be has done well for us.
Yeah. It's crazy, but when you think about it, all of this makes sense. I mean, you guys went, you know, you went through your changing or your
metamorphosis.
Wow. I have no words. like you went through your training and upbringing, you know, in places, and like you were saying, you know, where people loved what they did, you know.
Yeah.
And I think we're all shaped, whether we like it or not, you know, whether it's good or bad and whether we like it or not. By that, all of those things. Had no choice.
How Sarah was talking about when she started at Bartolotta's and everybody was just super excited all the time. You know, like we were all kind of following Juan's lead then, but I know I was definitely like a willing cheerleader Just totally nuts. But we had been looking for a place like that. Like, we were looking to get back to something that felt like that, you know. And Kalu Kenzo, kind of like Sarah was describing, you know, whether it was COVID or whatever it is that caused it, like, we're very tight, our staff. I'm staring at the karaoke rig that we had here Saturday night for after we closed, because it was one of the staff's birthdays. Mm-hmm. So we did karaoke. There's a whole vibe here, and I think the people here are a huge part of it. Allowing the staff to be themselves as individuals and take care of people in their own voice, I think, makes a huge difference here.
And I think it helps that Zach and I are here every single shift. There's been almost no shifts that have gone by that we aren't here. We don't have managers that run the floor. And I think that provides a different vibe. Like, you're working alongside the owners. And we definitely try to work as hard as everybody else, if not harder, because I think we've all worked in places where you're like, this owner has no, or manager has no idea, like, what the reality of the day to day, minute to minute, hour to hour situation is. And I didn't want this place to be that. I love working with our team. I love working in this team environment where there's not one position that's any more important than anybody else, because everything any of us do will impact everybody else. And I think that there's a real understanding of that on our team. Like, we all try to do our absolute best to make it as easy for everybody else as possible.
Yeah, yeah. And then you pair that with, I'm thinking about this now, and this conversation has been awesome. And I fully expected us to be talking way, way, way more about food. But it's interesting, because, and I'm thinking about this now, is that, you know, that can be incredible to talk about. But when places are good, like, it's absolutely also true that it's not just food.
Totally.
Like, it's never just food. It's always, and I always tell people, like, my job, the food that I get to experience in my job, you know, yes, I get to eat great, you know, that's amazing. But it's without the people. The people far surpass the food in terms of what I enjoy about my job, you know.
Totally. Good restaurants have to have good food. But if you want to be really great, like, I think you need to have something much more than that. The food is kind of the easiest to, maybe not the easiest, but it's the funnest part to kind of talk about, and you can kind of, like, articulate things about food. You know, the nuances of, like, the flow of service and how things like that run, I think, is not as easy to talk about, but is maybe even more important. You know, I think chefs get a lot of love in the media and just, you know, the Instagram and stuff like that. But
your jobs are so romantic, and, you know.
No, I don't know. I like it. It's not for everybody.
Oh, no, I think that too. But, like, there's that mythology, you know.
No, totally. I think if you work in a restaurant, like, I think people's vibes in restaurants are more like chefs than people realize. Like, I think it's this alternative career that people enter into where, for whatever reason, like, this is the workspace that you feel comfortable in with the kind of people that you're surrounded with that, you know, you feel like you can relate to. I think it's a special place. I call this place the Island of Misfit Toys, you know. I'm not even sure there's a lot of people who would hire me anymore. I mean, like, I'm good at cooking food, but I'm not a particularly great employee anymore at this point in my life. So I definitely feel like a little bit of an Island of Misfit Toy kind of ringleader out here. It's a special place, but I think that every position is important and the chefs get all the attention. But there's no way this place is what it is without a Sarah Baker doing her part in the front and managing that wine list and training the staff, you know, because I'm just kind of in the nitty gritty, like, you know, turning artichokes. Like, I'm not paying attention to any of that stuff.
Yeah. Well, I think that you have less occasions where you have a couple running a restaurant where you can kind of talk about both of the aspects and the complementary, you know, and to have people with skill sets that are really absolutely that yin and yang.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
Yeah.
That makes the machine run. You know, Sarah and all of your 52 jobs and 52 totally. Certifications. And, you know, I mean, and we can go back and say, okay, your first job at Starbucks where you're cupping coffee, you know, definitely, you know, at that point, you probably didn't even realize it, but that probably helped you when you got to the wine point. You
totally.
Know? And somewhere along the line, you had to have started really appreciating the food part.
yeah, thanks to Zach. So,
yeah.
We would have these epic, like, 8-course tasting menus with separate wine pairings we would make ourselves just for the two of us. Sometimes we'd have friends come over. But we would use, like, every plate and every pot and every mixing bowl. And it was like the kitchen would be thrashed at the end. But
who did the dishes?
Not us that night. Because, you know, 8 courses of wine pairings and Amari and DJ Stevie at the end.
Not the world's worst busser, I can tell you that.
Yeah. I wasn't that much better as a dishwasher at that point. I'm actually a very good dishwasher now at this point, feel like. But it's like a full circle thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Back in the days, I mean, and I was never to that level, but I remember, you know, we'd have people over at our house and having people for dinner was like, I don't know, my hobby. When I was working a day job, you know, a desk job, and I would come home and I'd be like, who can we invite for dinner? Who can we cook for? Who can we hang out with all night and just, you know, eat whatever the awesome things are? And yeah, I remember
culture shift since then, because I think my generation is like, no people over ever. I don't want to see.
but we'd sit there and stare at, like, we'd look at the dishes and be like, no. Nobody is doing those now. And the next morning you wake up to the dishes and you're like, that was so fun yesterday. Keep focusing on that.
Yeah.
Totally.
Cleaning up the fun from yesterday, you know.
You just take all the dishes out to the yard and grab the hose and just do it that way.
Seems expedient. So, yeah. So what are you looking at right now? I mean, we've talked about how you've kind of looked over time and been like, okay, Kali Kenzo is something different, you know, today, tomorrow. You know, you're looking on a new patio season. And I think, Sarah, I think you said to me, I think it was before the podcast started, that this is the first May 3rd that you will be open ever.
Yeah.
Because you opened after May 3rd the first time. And then there were 2 years where you weren't open on May 3rd, which is sort of extraordinary.
Yeah, it's crazy. You know. We're definitely looking forward to having 12 months in a row being open, going into our third year. Like, what?
Because it's kind of crazy because it feels like you've been around for a long time.
Yes.
But time has been way distorted for the last couple of years. Do you feel like you've been around for a long time? Like, do you feel like this has been forever?
It feels like a blink of an eye, like a new restaurant, and also like 100 years all at the same time.
The time space between 2019 and 2022 is undiscernible by the human brain. Yeah,
it's like light years.
Like, yeah. I just saw a tweet the other day that was mentioning like the Once Upon a Time in Hollywood Tarantino movie. And I was like, yeah, that was cool when that came out last year. And then it was like, my God, that was 2019.
Yeah.
That was three summers ago.
No, dude.
Yeah.
It's been weird. I feel like we just got here, but I don't really remember my life and jobs before Kalu Kenzo anymore. Like, it's just because it's such an all-encompassing sort of experience for Sarah and I. But it still seems like it's gone by very, very quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah. But every time I think we've been open for a long time, I'm like, everyone in the dining, no one in the dining room has ever been here before. Like, how is that possible? How, yeah. how is everybody that's sitting here their first time here?
Yeah, it's been years. Well,
and maybe not everybody in the dining room, but even like 15 years from now, you know, if you're still open 15 years from now, there will always be people, I think, in your dining room who've never been there.
Totally.
If I've learned anything about like looking across restaurants and, you know, making recommendations to people, people are always, where should I go? Where should I go? It's like, okay, well, I hope I can, you know, it used to be, well, I hope I can give you somewhere where you haven't been, right? Mm-hmm. And now it's like, oh, I most certainly can give you somewhere where you haven't been. Totally. Because most people go to, you know, there's maybe 3 to 5 places on their list where they go over and over and over again. And, you know, which isn't a bad thing because that's like, that's you being a regular, right? And supporting a place.
I mean, it's just human nature, I think. Mm-hmm. You find something you like and you kind of mind.
And you order the same things. You order the same drinks, you know. You do the,
we definitely do things like that. That's our MO.
Oh, yeah.
Well, and me like, too. I mean, we're all human beings, I think, in that regard. But if I had to ask you, if I had to ask you one more thing, it would be like standing here in the now, what do you see? Like, what's the most challenging for you? And like, what are you most excited about? Like, you know,
I think the most challenging thing for us right now is dealing with people saying we can never get into your restaurant and yet having 14 parties cancel for a total of 44 people last Saturday. Like, how, that's why you can't get in, because people make reservations and then cancel a couple days or the day of or a couple hours.
The customer, I'm pretty sure.
So having a 10 table restaurant with 12 seats at the pasta counter, that's a huge impact on us. Like huge impact to lose that. And when people already think you're difficult to get into, the chances that they're just going to pop by and be a walk-in are much less, because every time they try to make a reservation, they can't get in. So why would they try to come in on a Friday or Saturday? So that has been, I think, our biggest struggle recently. Like, how do you do that? Do you charge a deposit for reservations? Do you charge a reservation fee? Because, I mean, even if we charged a $5 per person reservation fee to all of those 44 people who canceled this past Saturday, like that accounts for 1 or 2 guests, whatever it would be, 3 guests sitting in the dining room that night. So that I think is something I did not anticipate being an issue.
It seems worse now than pre-COVID.
Which is interesting.
Like, I don't remember the reservation. And again, like, you don't want to be inflexible. Like, are all these people canceling because they think they have COVID? I don't know. It doesn't seem like I know that many people right now who are catching COVID. I'm not saying it's not out there, but the odds don't make me think that they're all canceling because of that. I think people speculate about what their plans are for the week, and they don't realize that they're kind of holding down a spot that we might not be able to refill when you find something better to do on Friday.
Right. Yeah. Well, and I do remember, like, stuff like this has, I think when you have a small restaurant, that this is like a more of a, definitely an everyday thing.
Totally.
But I remember talking with folks at Wolf Peach, and this is back when they were open, you know, Wolf Peach and Roots, at Roots is, you know, where they would rent out, you know, the whole root cellar for parties on there, you know, and sometimes like during graduation time, you know, folks from UWM or, you know, Marquette or somewhere would rent the whole level for a graduation celebration or a graduation dinner. And people were known for like reserving like 4 or 5 places and then deciding where to go at the last minute and completely dumping the other 4 reservations.
Totally.
So it'd be like a reservation for 100 people. Like, you bought out the place, supposedly, but didn't prepay for it.
That would require a deposit anyway.
That was, and I was going to say, no, and at that point, that was the conversation. Like, And I think places to get smart, like with something of that magnitude, like mm-hmm. you have to get people to commit, you know. But I think it's harder when it's it's a dinner reservation. And it's like, yeah, what do you do? How do you?
Well, and restaurants have always been so you show up, you get something, you pay, you leave for mm-hmm. decades. And I think that I would hate for people to think that restaurants see it like a money grab, but like we're just trying to run our business in a way that other people get to run their business. Like people don't get to like back out of a concert at the last second. You buy a ticket, you go. That means that somebody else can't buy that ticket. They have their stuff covered, right? Mm-hmm. You don't get to go to certain businesses and just hang out in for 3 hours after you stop spending money and just take up space. Mm-hmm. You know, like they're not at the doctor's office, they're going to tell you to go home, you know? It's complicated right now because you're fighting a lot of, you know, kind of financial things, but trying to like be hospitable. Like you don't want to seem ticky-tacky. Like you worry, is a reservation fee or a deposit ticky-tacky? And then 40 people cancel. And you're like, I don't know, man. Like maybe we do need to do something about this. We had deposits for a little while. But there was a kind of debate if it was helping us at all in the first place. Because it's kind of hard to keep that money. You still feel bad and a lot of it would get refunded. And it's also, it can be a little complicated closing the dinner out and trying to like apply credit to a bill when it comes to like how much gratuity and stuff like that. And for the most part, it was okay, but we did have a couple instances and, you know, more than one or two to me is going to be a problem because that's our staff's livelihood. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we've been talking about it a lot lately, just how to move forward with it.
Because it's not simple.
No.
It's not.
Yeah,
no.
It's not. Because everything you do impacts something else.
Yeah.
I mean, a deposit. If we take a deposit through our reservation system, that means that TOC gets to skim their fee. So we actually make less money mm-hmm. taking deposits than we would not taking them at all. It's a paradox a little bit.
Yeah. And how much of a deposit do you need to make? To keep a I think we can we're talking about this with the acknowledgement that yes, if tragedy strikes, like everybody's had a situation where they've had to cancel something, nobody's beating on those people, but when it's like I can't even bother
44 people is not 44 people had sudden deaths,
they suddenly realized the bucks were on.
Yes.
Yeah. So
people, like, sorry, not sorry. Yeah. Like, you have the internet, too. Like, you could have known that.
Right.
I'm just so mean I'm going to force you to come out and have a beautiful dinner.
You prick.
Yeah, it's so terrible.
Monster.
So terrible.
So, I mean, I guess that's like our biggest challenge in the scheme of things. Kind of glad that's our biggest challenge.
There's a re-educating of the public on manners overall, it seems.
Well, and I think there is. And I think we're dealing with an industry, where, costs are up. And, some places are lucky to retain staff, but, there's staffing things. And there's all these things for people to understand. And then there's all of these behaviors that people seem to have forgotten,
Mm-hmm. And, honestly, we make everything every day. So that number that is our reservation number for the day, that's how much food we're making, plus a little bit more for, the walk-ins. So, people will be upset if something runs out. And it's like, we literally every single thing on our menu we made today. So,
we'll
if everybody... Yeah, and if everybody all unexpectedly wants this one item... I promise you the other item that's available will be just as delicious as that one thing that was gone. But just, you got to work with us. Like, we don't have a freezer full of stuff that we can thaw.
Yeah. And I understand. Yeah. I understand disappointment, but I also am sort of like, I'd rather go to a place where they run out of something because everything is made fresh than
don't you go to the place where they run out of seafood?
I absolutely want to go to the sushi restaurant where they run out of sushi.
That's my place.
Yeah.
The film festival is going on right now. And if I go to a film festival movie and they're like, oh, it's sold out, I'm the happiest person in the world because I'm like, that's great. That means people are here and supporting you. That rules.
Well, it's sort of like that whole people waiting in line for things. It's like if I see a restaurant where people are waiting in line, and this could be also the Cheesecake Factory thing. Like you see people waiting in line. I don't know. I assume that that place is good.
Right.
Well, if there's no line and it's never hard to get in there, I don't know. Maybe it's secretly good, but more than likely it's probably not.
So we did a lot of nitty gritty background and restaurant talk this episode. We are going to have you guys back for a food conversation.
Yes, absolutely.
We had a whole list of food topics too, but we kind of got the origin story here. Like we had to set the table and now we'll just have to have you guys back.
Which is actually very true. Because at some point, and I don't know, I can't think of...
We have so much pasta to talk about.
You know, to talk about all the pasta shapes and all
When it comes to the restaurant thing, Sarah and I are kind of wonky about it. It's like more like you're hiring some analyst or something like that. I'm not trying to make it sound impersonal, but we very much think about this stuff
all the time.
Yeah. And the food is important, like we said, but there's... I think about it so much more broadly now that we have this place that is a reflection of the two of us.
Yeah. And restaurants are so fascinating. Like there's so much, they're so different and there's so many and it's just...
It's funny you mentioned that. I just saw a documentary about the Tokyo dining scene. And they start the documentary being like, there are more than 80,000 restaurants in Tokyo. It's this like bustling like food spot. And I'm just like, ooh, cool. And then the documentary kind of focuses on four fairly similar kind of places that seem like higher end kind of Tokyo dining situations. And I'm like, well, that's a bummer. Like,
narrow scope.
Yeah, like 80,000 feels like I should have learned about a whole bunch of crazy stuff. I should have learned about like, you know, the high end place and the place making stuff on a cart outside of an alley. And like,
I think about when you make the decision for that documentary and you're talking about a place with so many restaurants. Why you don't?
Don't lead with it has such a diversity of restaurants. Here are four of the expensive ones we found.
Here are four, far less diverse.
Lori, book them in. We're locking them in right now for dining month. It's happening. We're having them on to talk pasta.
That sounds great.
Cool. We'll talk.
This was absolutely fascinating.
This is not a complaint.
Because people might say, oh, talking about operations and all of that is dull. Meanwhile, by the way, I keep ducking because my laptop came unplugged and now it's running low on battery.
It's okay. If I don't plug it in, I might go away. I am lounging on a bed right now. So,
This was fascinating. People wouldn't believe me if I said, we talked about that. And
I think the nitty gritty of restaurants running is very interesting and very fascinating. And I think food can be hard to discuss because food is so sensory and visceral that it can kind of be hard to kind of convey, you know.
Well, sometimes it's just mean to talk about food on a podcast.
Well, that also. It's fun to talk about all. I don't know. The industry's cool. You guys are fun. We're going to have you on again.
Thanks.
Where can people find out more about Kalucenzo, though?
Kalucenzo.com. We have Instagram. And you can come to eat.
Yeah.
We have.
That's the best way.
Yeah. Yes. Our pasta counter is open for walk-ins. Our bar is open for walk-ins. You can eat at both spots. During the week, you can walk in and get a table.
When can people actually see pasta at the pasta bar?
That's a great question. It's kind of a moving target. Since we do make everything fresh every day, kind of depends on what day of the week it is, how busy we have been, how busy we are. But it's usually a pretty good bet that if you are here at 5 o'clock, Sam will be here making pasta.
See, that's a good reason. Like you have with those and Kalucenzo, you will need to make a reservation, and you just need to think about it ahead of time.
I mean, we do keep walking spots.
We do. Yeah.
But I'm thinking that is motivation for eating. You know, I always say 5 o'clock is eating with the old people, right? And like 8:30. I mean, I'm cool with post 8 o'clock reservations, but those are a hard sell.
No.
I think a lot of times in Milwaukee. But that 5 o'clock slot, if you can actually see the magic.
Totally. And our team is amazing. They will take awesome care of you and you'll have the best time.
Sold. I am sold. And now I am also hungry, and I was literally eating just before this podcast.
Yeah, there we go.
So. And we didn't even talk that much about food, and it's made me hungry.
It's the olives.
It's the olives. We didn't even.
The food world's aperitivo, the olives.
This October for dining month, we will have you guys on to discuss food and olives.
Very well.
Yeah, there we go. Done. I have a plan. I'll share later.
I'm terrified. Salty grape season is in.
All right. Thank you so much.
Cool.
Thanks for your time.
It was a pleasure.
And for everything that you do.
Thanks.
It's appreciated.
Thanks right back at you.
Call the podcast. An awesome conversation, as they always are on this show.
Yeah. Yeah, I know people who make food. People make food are good people.
They're good conversation. They're good chats.
And Zach and Sarah make, delicious food. Like, if you want house-made pasta, I can't think of a place where I would rather go to eat it. There's always something delicious on that menu. So, but I need to stop thinking about food right now because it just makes me hungry. So how about some food porn?
I think that sounds great. I think, what are we getting really excited about this week?
Well, I found this piece called The Love Cook by Ron Padgett.
Ooh, this sounds actually food porny.
And it might be a little. So I thought we'd try it out.
Yeah, we're doing it.
Sweet, short, sweet, to the point. So here we go with The Love Cook by Ron Padgett.
The Love Cook just sounds like a great name for something.
It does. A food truck. We'll see. Let me cook you some dinner. Sit down and take off your shoes and socks. And in fact, the rest of your clothes. Have a daiquiri. Turn on some music and dance around the house, inside and out. It's night, and the neighbors are sleeping, those dolts, and the stars are shining bright. And I've got the burners lit for you, you hungry thing.
He talks a lot about everything but the food, which is a concern to me.
Indeed.
Like, at no point does he actually, like, sound like he's actually making anything.
No, Ron. I'm pretty sure the burners are lit for something else.
Oh, snap. You think it's sexy time at the Padgett household?
I do. And I've never, you know, sexy time for me doesn't usually begin with a daiquiri, but I guess that's
no, that's a weird choice for a sexy drink. I don't normally think of daiquiris as sexy.
No. I don't know.
We should stop roasting Ron.
Poor Ron. No,
Man just wanted to make a daiquiri and write a sexy poem. And now he's got a podcast. Ron, you're doing great
work.
No, there's
nothing wrong with you, Ron. You wrote about the love cook. And I think that, like, ultimately it's like, I don't know. I'm probably projecting, but I feel like we just talked about really, really delicious Italian food. Italian food to me says romantic dinner, right?
Yes.
Even though technically that is also like against all logic when you talk about like carbo loading, you know.
Yeah, it is not like it's both aesthetically very romantic, but also aesthetically not at all romantic. Like it's a crap ton of starch.
Like you're probably eating things that might make you a little tired.
It's just a bunch of goop. It's a bunch of goop, Lori.
but it is delicious. And so I don't know.
I'm getting mauled by dogs right now. So
there are way worse things to be mauled by, Matt.
This is true. Could be two bears. So. But where can people find the Food Crush podcast before I die?
Yes, people can find us. You guys can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. where we mostly talk about the podcast, but we sometimes also introduce you to new interesting foods or our opinions on foods, which we hope to do hopefully this summer again. Woo! And how about you, Matt?
You can find me at A Man About Film on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and nowhere else. Lori, did you already say where we can find you in particular?
No.
Where can people find you, Lori?
But you can find me at Lo Frederick on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. And I roam around TikTok as well, but I don't actually post things. So you, that's my TikTok is like your Instagram.
You're a window shopper. TikTok.
Yeah, I just don't have time. Like, I would want to make like snazzy videos that people would want to watch, Nonetheless. I don't know. I think we're to the end of our podcast.
I think you can call it the end of a podcast.
Your dog may have stopped mauling you, though.
No, they're just all laying on me now, which isn't really better.
Just like sitting in silence waiting for the next time. Yeah.
All right. Keep cooking, everybody. Bye.